All right. What's the biggest mistake you've made as a coach and what do you learn from it?
I used to think coaching was about myself giving the answers to the athletes. When success comes, when you create good questions and force the athletes to solve them themselves.
Welcome to Social Kick. I'm Brian Lundquist. We got a partial crew. Luke's off gallivanting in London town, but we got Dr. John Mullen and we got Herbie Baim. What's going on, Herbie? How are you?
Hey, I'm great. Yeah. How about you guys?
Oh, we're doing awesome. All right. So we polled our audience though, before this show, and we got a few questions, especially from a bunch of your crew. So I'm just going to shout out Sun Devil Swim Dive and all your boys who are hitting up our Instagram. So this one's from the Sun Devil Swim Dive account. If you're stranded on an island with one person from the team, who would it be and why?
Ooh, that's a good question. I would pick John Heafy. He lived in Alaska for a pretty long time. He would be a good survivalist. I think he'd be the most prepared to help us survive. So he would be my go-to.
All right. He's got the toolkit. And this one's from your boy Mitochondria House. Yeah. Which one would you rather have for the rest of your life? Skyline Chili or Graders?
Oh, Skyline for sure. Yeah.
All right. Are we doing straight up Skyline or are you making some kind of dip out of it? I've had the Skyline dip before. It's pretty fire.
I would have the spaghetti. I put it on the pasta. That's the way to go. The three way.
Oh, straight up. All right, there we go.
Chili cheese conies all the way. Chili cheese conies. That's how you got to do it.
Those are solid, but you can't beat it. And it's like explaining to people also, like, no, you pour the chili on spaghetti. The first time they've seen that is like, what is happening? But it works.
That's all right. A slice of Americana. I love it. Yeah. All right. And then we had a bunch of questions from your crew asking about what you could go right now. Is this the year he goes 19 from Zach Dean Spire? What? Will he be going in a 50 free at the alumni meet from Christian? So hey, if you had to suit up right now or today, what are you going in a 50 free?
Well, we did it after our U of A meet, which to give myself some credit, it was 39 degrees. And when you're standing in that for 4 or 5 hours and then just hop up 5 minutes of warm up, I was 20.8. So that's the figure on a warm day. I could maybe get another 0.2 out of it, but that was pretty much all I had.
Hey man, that's pretty solid. I don't know, John, what could you go today?
Oh, I have been doing a little more speed work after my fun 100-100s that I did on New Year's, but I think I could probably go 21 low, maybe 21.3. I haven't worn a suit or done a dive in a while though, so I might need a little a little work on both of those things. Yeah, as in like
I've worn suits, but I prep for that, so I was ready to go.
All right, there you go. Yeah, you got to do some tempo work. I think that's the biggest issue for me is doing all this like loping stroke stuff and then not sprinting enough. And then when I see what kind of tempo you actually need to do elite sprinting, like I totally forgot. My body forgot what that's supposed to be like.
Yeah.
How about you, B? What are you going?
What am I going? Honestly, I've been lifting and I'm in good lifting shape. So even though I've been running primarily, I think I could probably hit 20 points something. I don't know what it would be, but... Yeah. I still got a little sauce. Don't you worry. Yeah, all right, Herbie, what's going on?
A pretty solid relay.
Yeah, I know. Actually, that one, we had another one from Swim Coach Joao asking if you had to pick four college coaches for a 4x50 coaches relay, what would it be? Who you got? Ooh.
Well, Joao, he would be one of them. He's pretty fast. I'm trying to think because you got to think of like the young people who are still not very far removed from the game. I know blanking on his name, but Mark Zoranek, I think, from Florida, who was pretty fast, not like just a few years ago. He would be fast. I actually think Margo Gear she'd be a dark horse. If there was a head coach's 53 relay, she would be one of the fastest in there.
Dude, her freestyle was just such a pretty freestyle.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be a fun one. I mean, yeah, maybe like that's for the alumni meet. So yeah. I don't know if anybody wants to see that at the NCAAs or Pac-12s.
Speaking of that, at our alumni meet, I had an idea that I would love to add to NCAA swimming. They should have like Saturday in between prelims and finals, an alumni relay of each team, but you have to be 10 years removed. and half, it doesn't have to be for points or anything, but like everybody can come back, suit up, because I think it would bring more people to the meet and give them an extra reason to go. And seeing some, like seeing the Auburn guys come back, I feel like they can still throw down something pretty fast. But then it would be like, it'd be cool, like all the old Auburn, all the old Cal guys, all the old U of A guys who were so competitive 10 plus yep. years ago, coming back and then like firing each other up. Like, you got to train this year, man. We got to be ready to go. I think that'd be a fun addition.
Dude, I'm having flashbacks to my sophomore year NCAA finals of the 200 free relay right next to Cal. And it was like the Dewey Dragania Cal team and the Fred Biscay Auburn team. And we lost that one, but that's all right. All right. So what's the update? What are you guys up to? You're coming into championship season. You obviously had a killer championship season last year, flip-flopping with Cal, winning the first Pac-12 title in program history on the men's side, continuing to, you know, see the rise on both the women's and the men's side. So just how's this season been going, and what's going on with the 2024 Sun Devils?
Yeah, it's going really good. Training wise, it's been really better than ever. So now it's just kind of landing the ship on this taper. We're just under 2 weeks out for the women, just under 3 weeks out for the men from PAX, and then plus 3 more weeks for NCAA. So yeah, starting to get dialed in there. But it's been good. I'm pretty excited to see how it goes this year, because it's something I've been pushing for well before I started coaching. But we actually suited up every single meet this whole season, and I think that'll be. I think we're more prepared to race because of that. So yeah, I'm excited to just see how it goes, because it's a little different. In previous years, last year we suited up the whole second semester. But actually, like, knowing where you are in training year round, rather than like using these kind of skewed, unsuited, unshaved time, saying like, okay, we're going to be this much faster when we put suits on, but not being sure of that, has helped a lot. So yeah, I think we have a little more information as we taper now. I'm excited to really obviously want it to end up well, but regardless, we'll have a lot of new information at the end of this season.
With suiting up and dual meets, is that, like you said, mainly just to get kind of data points, or is it also to build confidence with the athletes? What is maybe the overall philosophy behind suiting up so often at these dual meets?
Yeah, the biggest reason for us is that just information. Like, I think just training, periodization is a huge part of what we do. And it's always been, I think we always get skewed information when we're not actually suiting up. Like, we don't actually know where we are. It's interesting, because in the swimming world, we like to say, oh, look how well we tapered. Look how well this went. But it's like, well, yeah, you shaved and put suits on and went to a prelims finals meet. Like, if that isn't your fastest time of the year, you did a horrible job coaching. Now we can at least see each person, kind of see how they trend through. Some people with very little rest, some people with more rest, if they're going good times, rather than being like, oh, that was just a pretty good swim. It's like, okay, we're actually comparing it to where we are at the end of the season all year long. Also, what I think is probably more important, at least from the athlete side of things, we're putting a lot more pressure on them every single time we race, because they're not allowed to say, oh, I'm a suited swimmer, so I go faster when I'm suited. Or like, I'm a shaved swimmer, so I'll go faster when I shave. So those kids, we normally say, well, you have to shave for all these meets now, because you're not going to hide behind a razor and have that be the thing that makes you fast. It's like, no, you have to figure out what actually makes you fast and not just do that one time a year. and I think if we do that over and over again, we'll get better at it and kind of understand the process. And then it's also like as simple as, you're figuring out how to swim your races. It is much different when you're shaved than when you aren't. especially for some of the super hairy guys. So practicing that a few times is important.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when we swam, you know, having like the mesh drag suits like midway through the thigh at a dual meet, and how much that like changes your overall race plan. And like you mentioned, just that psychology of like, I'm a taper swimmer. I'm not, you know, you really mail it in. And I think, you know, it really doesn't prep you for the pre-meet nerves and like the taper nerves that a lot of athletes have to deal with, that anxiety. So it's interesting to, like you said, hear all the different facets of why this is becoming more common and how it's not just, you know, purely a technical reason.
Yeah, because it helps us and it gives us more accurate information as the coaching staff as well in terms of deciding who's going to the meet, because it's like the kind of bottom spots for Pac-12, rather than, it's like before, if you didn't go to midseason, all of your times were invalid because you're not going to beat these other guys. Like if you're not wearing a suit, like I literally was looking at it, some of our results from like 2 years ago at like these end of the year, like our Cal Stanford, similar time of year dual meet. And we had like 100 breaststrokers going 57s. And I remember looking back, it was like, okay, this person's totally going. Where now they're all going 53s, but it's like, okay, part of it, this guy was probably a similar level of performance, but he just didn't get a chance to ever swim in a suit and we didn't get to see that. So now it's exactly that, to where there are some people who are much better with suits on or shaved or whatever that is. And actually using that every meet as an opportunity is much more valuable, and they feel the pressure of that rather than like, oh, because I think we do it to protect our own egos and the athlete's egos from having to like, oh, touch and look up and be like, oh man, I have to drop a second and a half in a 50. Where when you're I remember when I swam, it was always pretty much, if I could be within 1 second of the time I wanted to be shaved and a suit on, I knew I was going to do that. But like, why not just do that each time and try and actually get there? And then we're learning what actually occurs in the training and how rest affects them, rather than just changing the organism basically by changing what they're doing.
Yeah, I'm having flashbacks as a hairy dude who used to race dual meets with a thick beard, going 20.8 at a dual meet and thinking in January and thinking, oh my God, like, what are we doing here? And then shaving down and 10 days later going 19.5 at the conference meet, and then, you know, 19.1 at NCs. I'm like, okay, everything's okay. But like, I was in that exact example of a second and a half needed to drop. Like, I don't know. I'm excited about this trend with suits and kind of evening out some of the opportunities that you have throughout the year to understand like how to race, because purely because I'm tired of this narrative that I feel like we see a lot more in the women's field in recent years, because there's not as significant of a drop from in season to later in the year, but like people celebrating an in season swim and going, ah, she wasn't even shaved, or he wasn't even tapered for this. It's like, there's so many varying degrees to this of preparation. Like, I think this is trending in the direction of just like getting rid of that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's exactly that. And kind of culturally in swimming, we have this idea that like, okay, the last meet has to be the fastest one. And if that's not your fastest swim of the whole year, you've kind of failed. And I don't know why we think that, because it's like, okay, what do you need to do to be prepared to go this, to have the fastest end of the year, not have the end of the year be the fastest. So you're kind of dealing with a lot of different individual psychologies that go into that. And in my opinion, some people who have struggle with performing at the end of the year, it might help them to like, oh, look, you've already done this time three different times. You just have to now figure out how to do that under this kind of new environment, and just different ways of going about it, rather than, I mean, I know it was when I swam as well, it would be like, okay, the morning of the dual meets, we'd have a 5,000 yard practice before to make sure we're extra bad. So then when we get rid of that, we'll be ready to go. But it's like, why are we just sabotaging ourselves the whole year And then it's like, well, look, you dropped 2 seconds in your 50 from the dual meets. And you're like, well, yeah, because like I was not thinking clearly, basically. So if you do that, it's much better. And like there's sometimes when you're just on for whatever reason, and if that's an NCAA record, if that's whatever it is, why are we actively avoiding that?
Yeah.
Now we're talking at the meet level, but you know, we peel back another layer, we could probably say similar things at the practice level, right? Where it's like, hey, if we get them going faster, get them more race-like experiences physiologically, psychologically, biomechanically, these things should build confidence and translate more. Is that a philosophy that you carry as well?
Oh yeah, 100%. Like I think that's what it's been cool from my experience to see ASU grow in that sense, to where like when I first started working with the sprinters, there was really like two or three good ones who were like going to do something at an NCAA level. And it was more about training them. Like it's always still about that. But then when we do fast stuff, it's like, okay, just seeing how fast they can go. Now it's like, okay, here's these three guys who are all really fast. We put them in a heat together and make them race. That makes it just more specific to the race. Or like what we're doing this afternoon, we'll do some 25s on the blocks. And there's a couple of kids who are the fourth and fifth spot on the relay. And they're fighting over who's going to be in that. And they're just going next to each other every rep for that. So it's making it like very clear as to what what the intention is. And it makes it much more like a race. Like, okay, I got to do this while the guy I want to beat is right next to me. And then when you do that enough times and you go to the meet, it's another day. Like one of the things we always say is how you do anything is how you do everything. And that's something we say in the classroom and in all of what we do, because you can't really spend your life preparing for a moment to be ready for that moment. You have to be in the moment all the time. So then when the moment comes, you're just like, you've rehearsed that and you're just living a life like that. And that's what we try and do, where we're racing, competing all the time. I mean, literally like 2 or 3 times a week, we're suiting up in practice and trying to put them in situations to where they're not only doing stuff that's specific preparation, but also in an environment to where they're next to other people who they're trying to be. And then by the time we get to NCAAs, hopefully no matter who it is in their heat, they're prepared because they've just been racing so much.
I was just listening to Andy Reid talk about Pat Mahomes and how he was like reminiscing with him among the coaching staff and Matt Nagy, the offensive coordinator in Kansas City, just saying, hey, like, do you ever get used to this? Because he does some magical things both in practice and in games, and it's totally abnormal. And they're like pinching themselves. And sometimes it's easy to just take for granted some of the things that you see, because you see it on a daily basis. Yeah. And then you go elsewhere and it's like, oh, this isn't really that normal. Yeah. I'm just curious, like, especially when you start to integrate suits into practice and stuff, are there some things that you, coming from a swimming background yourself, are going, shit, man, that's pretty impressive?
Yeah, it's kind of like that. Like, that's what, going back to what I was saying earlier, it's really cool seeing how just our team has grown. And now it's like the bar is constantly being raised. And yeah, sometimes you like take a step back and like, okay, that was pretty good. Like on Wednesday, we did just 350s on 6 minutes, like suited as fast as we could with 100 breathing in our back pool. That's 3.5 feet deep on one side, 5 on the other. And it's funny because there was like, it was years of, oh, if anybody can go 19 back here, that's the, like, we have the back pool record. And it was like, for whatever reason, nobody could break 20 back there. I knew it was like fast swimmers like Brad Tandy. A lot of good swimmers couldn't do it. And then during that set, we had 4 different people average 19. So it's like, okay, we're getting pretty solid. And just same thing, like you're going from, those are all from a push back there. And that was stuff that like literally the whole time I was in college, nobody went 19 on our team the entire time I swam. So the fact that it's like, okay, we're just kind of doing these on repeat is cool. And that's like where you don't really realize how much the training partners help until it's like, it is the right environment. So to them, it was probably try not to make too big of a deal about it. So they don't get big heads or anything. But yeah, it honestly happens all the time. Like this year, I know that just the type of people that we have all with kind of the same Olympic dream all in one spot, it is rare. So I try and appreciate that. And yeah, when we do that, it's cool. I mean, I'll give you another example. Last Saturday, Michael Phelps just came to practice. Like he just walked in to like say hi to Bob, and he had Boomer and Allison Schmidt were with him. And like you can see, we were all doing fast stuff. So you can like see when he walks in, everybody's like, okay, we got to go super fast. And like first thing we did, Ryan Held went 50 from the blocks long course. And I had him at 21.5 on that. And it was one of those things where it's like, Michael Phelps is here. I got to go for it. And like every person in the pool was like, we got to give everything we have right now. So it's like, that has kind of taught me how much the environment affects the individual and vice versa, to where we have a really special environment all the time. But then it's like, okay, the GOAT just walked in. Everybody's got to, this has to be every person's best practice ever. So yeah, I mean, stuff like that, I know doesn't happen often. So yeah, it's definitely fun to be a part of.
So does Bob just have, you know, Phelps, you know, and it's just like, hey, we're having a bad practice. I need you on deck. Or it's like, leading up to the Olympics, it's like periodized in there when Phelps shows up to your guys' workouts.
That's what, yeah, we gotta start figuring that out. I'm sure that we could, because it's like, okay, if Leon's doing like a really intense 400 IM practice, like, all right, you need to come in like halfway through. So then it just like raises the bar.
Now you mentioned, like you said, some of the backyard pool and the records there and the caliber of athletes raising each other up. But what are some, I don't know, swimmers always like to talk about sets. What are some, you know, creative ways or unique ways you're trying to harness and get more speed out of the athletes that you have?
I mean, that's kind of the question we're trying to answer, like literally every practice. so and I think the best way is constant variety and constant like new stimulation in what we're doing. So it's like every single week is quite a bit different, at least what we're doing. So there's a ton of ways to do that. I mean, like our max speed stuff. I think one of the things that we do well is it's a pretty specific stimulus on the whole practice. And we're actually trying to not like mush too many things of differing stimuli into one practice. I think that's something that a lot of coaches make a mistake of, to where it's like, okay, every practice has to be 4,000. So on their like max speed power days, they do that fast stuff, and then they're like, okay, now we've got to do 15 100th pull just to get some of that in every time. Yeah. So we'll have like a pretty major variety in what we do. Like a specific example, there was Swim did our practice in pancakes where we did 20 or suited 25s from the blocks, like odds with fins, evens without, which I think is a really good set, because I think it's psychologically when you're going suited 25s on the block with fins and you hear like 7-0 for your time, it's just exciting. And then also the physiological thing, just like having to hit a good breakout in that and overspeed that way. When you do that, come right back to no equipment, you can normally hit it better because it feels like you're almost doing it in slow motion, even though that's your truly max speed. But it's also like the day before that was actually, like a 6,400 meter workout, but it was all super low intensity. And I think that's something that we, don't talk about the importance of, and I'm not even saying like in terms of getting volume in, but training at a low intensity and actually exposing yourself to that. I think there's obviously like the metabolic and cardiac effects of just being at a low intensity there, but I think there's like a parasympathetic of response as well. And we can train that and improve that ability, which will then just improve our recoverability. And that's something we have a pretty big emphasis on, to where on those days, almost all, there's chunks of times when there is intervals on it, but the majority, there's no intervals. And it's just like going through it at your own speed and allowing them to, where it's like, you need to get out of the water feeling better than you went into it. So I think that approach throughout the week is good, to where we have 1 to 3 of those just super low intensity, long, where they're just going, I mean, literally swimming slow, like where it's pretty boring to watch. But mixing that in, mixing those max speed days where it might be 1500, but every single stroke is fast the whole way. And then kind of speed endurance days to where it's just 6 to 8 50s as fast as you can on an interval, and keeping those very distinct, but then in themselves always changing how we do it. So it's a new task, but still the same stimulus. So you're kind of getting the response, but keeping you psychologically engaged and keeping just like the, just constantly learning new skills is the goal of that. And I think if we do that all the time, then it's engaging, because you're not just literally coming in and going through it over and over again, but you know what you're doing, why you're doing it, and then also being forced to learn each time.
Yeah, I think especially with attention spans amongst the youths now, that's appropriate, but even more so amongst sprinters, we just get so excited and so jacked up that it's hard to like keep everybody's focus for a while. So I'm curious what some of your influences are to keep things fresh and have new ideas. I recall when Brett Hawk first retired from elite swimming, right after Commonwealth Games in the mid 2000s. And he came in and started coaching the pro group. And it was like a lot of variety, so many ideas from his pro career. And he would bring them into the strength program as well as into the pool. And it was like every day there was something different. And it was like really thriving in that group. And so it sounds like a lot of what you're describing is like the influences to bring into this group to keep things fresh and exciting and new, but like, you know, just a different stimulus. So what, like, are you a naturally curious person? What are your influences outside of even the coaches that you have on deck to help bring into writing a workout to keep these elite athletes engaged on a daily basis?
Yeah. So I guess my biggest influence in terms of my coaching is Anatoly Bondarchuk, who's written a ton of books, but he was a throws coach. He coached the hammer. Some pretty impressive stats. He's actually coached every world record in the hammer. Like he held it as an athlete in 1968. And then every world record he coached gold, silver, and bronze for 5 Olympics in a row. So this guy's like knows his stuff. But his organization of training was really cool. And it's pretty far ahead of his time, because now it's like, there's like a type of motor skill development called differential learning, where it's just exactly that, of like adding a ton of variety and basically trying to solve the same task in a ton of different ways is the best way of teaching a technique, because your brain will basically like learn the average of it. And that's normally the most efficient way. So if you have a technical flaw, I mean, for something we did this morning, with the pro specifically, they had fins, drag socks, mitts, paddles, all of these different things, and hitting tempo with a different just things on their hands and feet each time. So it's like, it is a completely different task each time, but the goal is to like find rhythm at a 50 or 100 tempo. And you can just see when they have the mitts on their hands, like the way they're putting it in is much more efficient, even though it's like, we didn't talk about that at all, but like it's the, he finds a way to do that. And that was the Bondarchuk approach. He did it teaching the hammer, but it was, the way he did it, in honesty, a lot differently than the way I implement it. But he would basically, once you've done a stimulus until they reached a peak that he kind of determined, they would literally never do that again for the rest of their careers. So it's like forcing the coach to constantly make new stuff. And that's kind of what I try and do, because I think it's exactly that. It's like, once you reach max level, you stop leveling. So you know how to do this. You're not going to gain any new information by just repeating the stuff we know you know how to do. I guess to disclaimer, there's obviously times when it's like, okay, this person's struggling. Like, let's just put in a tempo trainer and just make this look good for a couple of days. And like, they're going to self-organize and find their rhythm naturally by themselves. But in order to grow, we have to keep learning. So that's the challenge for myself. And that's what I think makes it fun. It's like knowing, okay, the stuff we did last year in this time of year, we can't just do that again, because we'll at best be the same we were last year. Reality will be just a little bit worse. So it has to be new. So that's what is, can be hard, because it's like, oh man, but this worked super well last year. What if we just keep doing this? But then it's like, myself, when I consciously think of like, okay, well, what the years that went really well, one, I can remember like at those times, a lot of times, like kind of freaking out and not knowing exactly what to do. So that was the mindset that I had going in. It wasn't like, oh, I have this plan and we're just going to do it. It was like, okay, looking at this person, why are they not swimming the 100 free as well as I'd like them to? Which part of the race are they struggling with? Which part of their technique are they struggling with? And then what I have to try and figure out is, how can I make a set or add equipment that teaches them what I want them to do, ideally without me saying it? So if we can do that, then it's perfect. Because then it's one, I think that's the way we develop feel, is through feeling, not through talking about it. And two, if they kind of find the answers themselves, they've kind of internalized it, and then they have this confidence of like, I know what to do and how to do it. And then if you do that over and over again, then the problem is, okay, swim this 100 free as fast as you can in Indianapolis. They can figure that out themselves and hopefully don't need me to do anything at that point, because there's not much I can do.
Yeah, I thought a lot of great points there. And, you know, Brent Rushall, the creator of USRPT, one of my major issues with him, especially when he came out with like his sprint training, was just like, hey, you just like sprint and think about your sprinting and repeat it. But,
oh yeah,
you know, I think anyone that's been around like a college team or even like any swimmer that's been swimming for years needs some more variety than that. Like, most people need a little bit more variety. And yes, it's like, you know, think about the technical elements and your flaws and, you know, keep working on it and, you know, have mental training and other things too. But, you know, having some variety is, I think, like you said, crucial for the athlete's mind, but also for them to hopefully garner some new skills as well. And, you know, one person that's doing different things in the pool is, you know, Cam McAvoy and, you know, his sprint type of training. And we had an audience question ask about kind of your thoughts on maybe his training, and maybe if you could expand maybe into how you guys use resisted swimming in the sprint group at ASU.
Yeah, no, that's great. Obviously what Cam's doing is incredible, and he's kind of taken that to all new heights, which is really cool. And talk to him a little bit. The way he thinks about it, I think, is really cool too, to where he's doing stuff kind of mixing the metabolic side and the resistance side of things together even more than ways that I had thought about. It really helped me also. But yeah, that's exactly it. And that's something that we do exactly that with we do a ton of resistance training. The most basic that I think is the most useful is just power racks, where we're just timing how long it takes to do that and like doing it under 5 seconds, which I think is great because it keeps it alactic, at least mostly. So they're not very fatigued, even if we do 12 all out efforts on that. But it goes back to that. Once you've done it a ton of times, you have to change it into how you're doing it. So we've got there's buckets as well. We've done, we timed full 25s, different weights. One of the most useful inventions of this year, it's not really other people have used it too, but we've made these sponge bags, basically. Like it's a mesh bag that we just put sponges in and pull that. And I actually think that loads a different part of the stroke than the racks and buckets. Because when you watch them swim with the racks on, it's all like kind of how you start your catch. And if you do that well, the whole thing goes really well and the weight moves up really quickly. But with the sponge and our little sponge bag behind them, it almost forces the second half of the stroke, because as you accelerate, the sponge, it just doesn't accelerate as very well, basically. So it's like a super constant force through the water. There's no jerks whatsoever. And when you watch somebody swim with a chute, it's like really jerky. And like when you're kicking, it's all moving around. This stays exactly still. So there has to be pressure the entire way through the stroke. So I think that's really good. And that's where, to answer your question, what I try and do is look at like, okay, which part of the stroke is this person struggling with? And that's the type of resistance that they need to do. If they're struggling with where it's entering and stuff, that's where mitts will be really good. If it's just like through the kind of center of the stroke, the sponge will be good. If it's how they catch up top, it's the, just put them on the heaviest rack possible. And it's like their body will find the most efficient way to solve that. So that's what I think. Clearly Cam McAvoy is doing something incredible in that aspect, but that's where we as a sport can do a really good job of, is actually just critically thinking more, rather than like, oh, Cam McAvoy does heavy buckets, so everybody's going to just do heavy buckets all the time. It's like, okay, well, that probably will help a lot of people, especially if they had never done it before. But looking at the individual's technique and kind of where it is, and then how that changes through a season, is when it really gets tough, because it's like, oh, they're getting a ton of reward from these super heavy buckets. We're just going to do that all the time. Then they start leveling off. What I'd like to do is, okay, once we do that right before they start leveling off, that's when we change it and find a new thing to add in and hopefully have them keep progressing forward.
Having you talking about sponges and parachutes made me remember like how much I freaking hated using those things, because I would like get my toes all cut up on the rope or the band. Has anybody solved for this problem yet?
Not really. We're trying to do the Bluetooth ones, but I don't know if we can figure that out yet. I think ours are pretty, like mine is, it's paracord that I literally bought at Home Depot. So it's really thin. And it's like soft. So these kids have actually said they like it more than the chute, because the chute has like kind of a long strap that's a kind of stupid design. So even for our chutes, we just put the little paracord on that, because they kick it like, it's exactly that. That's the same thing when I swam. I'm just like, you're basically asking me to just cut my toes up when I'm just kicking this thing over and over again. The paracord helps a little bit, but it's one of those things that, that's why I think the like racks and buckets, just because they're out of the water, you're not kicking them as much. But yeah, we got to figure that out better.
But I think it's so funny that like one of the things that seems to be like a staple of sprint groups where at a high level is coaches going to Home Depot to make stuff better.
I like that part. So like I'm really into all the like Soviet authors and Soviet coaches back in the day, and at all the top Soviet schools, they would have underneath, or at least part of their gym or pool or wherever there was, they had a workshop of just welding tools and stuff where the coaches were expected to make their own equipment. So I always feel like a tribute to them when I'm at Home Depot trying to figure out how to make whatever I have in my mind.
All right. Well, you have your Soviet books, your hammer throw books, your racks, your sponges. Mr. Kyle Sockwell wants to know, what would your best time have been in the 50 free if you have gotten to coach yourself?
I I think I would have gone 18. I'm pretty confident. I think I had the ability because, like, I went 19.8 as a 17-year-old back in the day, and then just got way slower when I got to college. And I think that was the coaching. So I feel like I have the ability, if it was now, to feel like I could have gone 18 with everything I know now. Assuming I would have listened to myself, which I probably wouldn't have, because at that point, I think I was not easy to coach. But in the perfect world where I actually trust myself, I think I could have could have gone 18.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit more about, you know, Pac-12s and NCAAs coming up. Cal and ASU is building quite a rivalry here, not just within the dual meets where you guys had the legendary tie this year.
Yeah.
But you guys went in Pac-12s last year. I was there. That was a great atmosphere. And then Cal won NCAAs, once again, a great showing overall for you. So what's the team's mindset and goals leading into these meets?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's doing the best we can and hopefully coming out on top of everything. Now it's nice that it's the first time that the end of the year is NCAAs. Even last year, it was like we might be able to win PACs. And then things were like going, and like at the beginning of the year, that was the end goal. And then as we went, it was like, oh, we might have a chance at NCAAs, but that literally didn't happen until like PACs. So this time we've at least done that. We kind of know, hopefully we'll be much better at managing the emotional side of things through. Because the comp, like whatever your end of the year meet is, when it's like, okay, you've done that, 3 weeks later, we got to do it again, but better. That's hard. So now we'll at least have a little bit of expectation at the end. So like regardless of how PAX goes, we kind of know the end goal is later on. And we're just more experienced because it's literally our third time doing it. Because the first year we had a good team was 2020, where if you scored out the psych sheets, I think we would have gotten sixth or seventh at that NCAAs, but NCAAs didn't happen. So then we didn't have that meet. Then we redshirted that whole year. All of those guys are pretty much gone now. So then we were sixth 2 years ago, second last year. Hopefully we can be better this year, but like having those guys who've actually gone to NCAAs before is a huge help, like obviously, but the 2 years ago it was Grant House was the only one who had been to an NCAAs on our entire team. So like that helps a lot because even like for myself in 2019, yeah, I guess it was the with ASU, we had one relay. Remember, our 400 free relay got eighth, but that was really our only experience in a NCAA final. Literally anybody on our team. So now that we've actually had some people go and kind of understand like, okay, it's, you got to be ready for these mornings. You got to be ready for more than just the swimming part of it, I guess. It'll help a lot. Because it's not just the coaches who are at least think that we understand what's going on when the whole team has done it before and understands it. Like the kids who this will be their first time, they at least have some guidance rather than us all just doing it for the first time ever. I mean, one thing that was kind of funny last year, because it was the first time we ever got on the podium. We literally didn't know you were supposed to have like a banner to take a picture with when you stand up on when you get the trophy, because we're like, we've never had this before. And then 2 years ago I also remember realizing like, oh, we don't know what we're doing, because we just happened to get to the airport the same time as Cal, and they had these boxes for all their trophies and stuff, and we were just carrying all of ours, and we're like, oh, we didn't even think about you get trophies and stuff either. So it's like, okay, we're figuring it out as we go, but hopefully this year we'll at least be more prepared than previous years.
That's all right. There's some excitement around, you know, not having that whole been there, done there sort of mentality, right? Yeah, so sure. Like I'm sure that's bred a lot of excitement amongst the team. You know, coming into these years, it's like, oh, they planted those seeds of potential. I'm just curious, like, how much easier is your life recruiting now versus what it was a few years ago? I mean, having to like knock down doors and get in conversations and have versus like top athletes be contacting you and genuinely interested in, okay, what do I need to do to get on this team? What does it take to be successful? Like, is it any easier now?
I don't think it's easier. And honestly, I don't think the recruiting ever gets easier. But it does change a lot to where now it's like, you were not having to just beg people to come. And exactly that. I mean, it's, there's people who are interested and are actually reaching out to us and like schools they're considering or other top schools, which literally was never the case before. So yeah, it's definitely, I mean, I guess parts of it have gotten easier for that sense to where like the top 25 kids in the class, it's not just an immediate no. So that's nice.
Well, one of your, you know, freshmen or top recruits had a really tough question or really wants to know. Ilya Karun wants to know, who's the best flyer?
Who's the best?
This is what he submitted.
Who's the best flyer? He wants the answer to be him.
I know he does. I'll let you pick whoever you want.
I mean, who's the best flyer? That's the most Ilya question we can think of. he's a very good flyer. Leon's a pretty good flyer too. He's one of the best. It's one of those things of like he could be so fast in a 200 fly and like literally might never do it. So yeah, I mean 50 fly. Ilya is one of the best there is in short course yards 50 fly. So I'll give Ilya this. It's Ilya.
So what could Leon go 200 fly yards if we saw him shaved and tapered? Do you think?
I'm probably 134. Yeah. 134, 130. Yeah. At least. Yeah. He'd be really fast.
Yeah. Like you said, I doubt we'll ever see it, unfortunately, but that'd be something.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be, I mean, it's like not really that much different than his 200 free. Cause he's kicking all the way to 15 every time on that. So it's like, it's just open turns, four strokes a fly each lap. Like, he doesn't really somehow get that tired, so it's just cranking the whole way. He'd be fast.
So with some of these guys that have such versatility, like back to Ilya, you know, he's putting up pretty impressive 50 free times, 50 fly times, but is obviously a 200 swimmer as well. Are you, you know, involved in much of his sprint stuff at all, or how does the ASU kind of coaching team work with some of these guys that have the huge range, especially for the yard season?
Yeah. Not a ton for Ilya right now, just because he's still like, it goes back to that. I mean, one of the analogies I like is the funnel effect. Like as you get more developed, your funnel gets smaller. And for Ilya, it was like literally racing open water was making him go 45 in the 100 fly in high school. So it's like his funnel is still huge. And having the emphasis, especially for this summer, on a long course 200 fly, like he's getting all the work he needs for that, obviously with Bob. And it's just kind of a bonus where it's making him fast at the 50 also. So as he develops, we'll probably have to make some changes to that and give him some more of like the real power, super explosiveness. But right now it's been like, training for the 200 fly made him go 18 and a 50 free. So I'll just keep doing that.
I don't understand these swimmers. It's like, you know, it's like Kate Douglas, you know, 50 free, two breast combo. Like what is it about these athletes? Like, is there anything that you can see in somebody like Ilya that like gives those indicators as to why he's able to translate training and of what seemingly would be like a very different way into, you know, sprinting?
It's like, I think his just capacity is so high that it is like, he still is able to have very high outputs, even on sets or types of practices that most people wouldn't. Because he can go long course hundreds holding, like if the interval is 110 for long course hundreds, he can actually do that super easily. And then if there's 225s fast in between, where some people that's like more of like recovery, just like a easier interval, he can just turn it on and go really fast on that. Leon's the same way, to where he just has this super high capacity, and you can like watch him doing stuff that for almost everybody else in the group is really hard. He's able to do it fairly easily. And then when it's like, okay, go fast on this, he's going like literally pushing 20 points at the end of a threshold set where everybody else is dying. He just like is so fit that he can just keep going. And then like a couple deep breaths on the wall, he's back to 100%, to where some of us didn't have that. And would we just have to sit for like 20 minutes to be able to have a decent 25 fast? He can just like, just go. So yeah, those guys are just like built different and can turn it on when they need to in very impressive ways under a lot of fatigue. That's where it goes back to, it's everybody's relative ability and relative capacity. And like, I mean, like a 8K workout for Leon, Ilya are relatively easy. So it's just like literally the way they're perceiving practice is much different than the regular of us.
Yeah, that's so crazy. It's reminded me of Ryan Lochte was a like more of a 200, 400 guy, but I remember being at Short Course Worlds with him, and like he was swimming events like the 50 free. Like I was, US had two guys swimming the 50, and it was me and Lochte.
Yeah.
And then he was also doing like the 50 breast, and I remember him getting out of 100 IM, and then all he did, he didn't have any time to warm down. He had 13 minutes between events, and all he did was just go sit on his legs. He was just trying to like get some of the lactate out, and then came out and I think he medaled again. It's like, these guys are just built different, you know?
Yeah.
And meanwhile, you've got, you know, Nathan Adrians of the world who have lactate numbers in the like 18 to 20. So
yeah.
Can't imagine.
It's just not fair.
Yeah. Do you guys get lactate readings on like Leon in practice? And he's just like where Phelps and those guys are at more or less, that they just move through it so quick.
Yeah. Yeah. We've gotten that before. And even, I mean, like I remember at Worlds is 400 IM prelims. It was like six and then back to one or two, like within 15 minutes after finishing. So it's like, okay, he's got a ton in the tank. And that's the thing that those guys have that's so good, is they can clear it really fast. And like somebody like Ilya can still get it up very high. But it'll come down super quickly. Leon's the same way, to where it's like he kind of has to be almost peaked in the time of the season to really get those numbers high. But no matter what, it's coming down super fast.
I remember messing around with sodium bicarb, like baking soda, and you put it in like a 16, 20 ounce Gatorade. Yeah. And so I tried it at like an in-season long course meet and then swam 100 free. And that was the only time in my life I ever cleared in like 10 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
I cleared so fast, but then I was on the toilet for the rest of the day.
That's what I was going to say. Most people, it's not worth it, to where you're like either throwing up or
But I felt amazing after 10 minutes, and I'm like, oh, this is what it's like to be Michael Phelps.
Yeah.
Like, how fast he recovers.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, it takes me 30 minutes and I'm never down to one or two. It's like three to five.
All right. One more question on Leon. If he was fresh for every event at NC's, how many events do you think he would win at the meet?
I think he would win. I think he'd win all of them except, I don't know if he could win the 50, because it's like, I don't know if he's got like an 18-1, 18-0 in him. He'd be in the final for sure. I mean, he'd probably go 18-4. I don't think he'd win the mile, although he might. I would think those two he'd least likely win. And then Hubie is pretty good at his 200 yak would be pretty tough for him to win. I think he would be 135. Could he get his hand on the wall first? I'm not sure. But like if it was a 14-day long meet and he got to swim one race each day, he would be really good. That would be a pretty fun way of doing it. Set it up like, okay, worst races first, best races last, and it's just like going after him for a while. But yeah, he like it's crazy how versatile he is. But yeah, 50 and mile would be his biggest struggles, but the rest of them he'd be worthy to bet on.
Yeah, what an incredible thought, but I definitely agree with you.
Yeah.
All right, Herbie, we got a few rapid fire questions.
All right.
What's the hardest race in swimming?
53.
Olympic gold or world record?
Olympic gold.
Actually, I have a new one on this. Olympic relay gold or an individual world title?
Olympic relay gold.
Okay. Especially with everybody swimming worlds right now. All right, what's the greatest swim you ever saw live?
Caleb 17.6. That made me like ponder existence for 15, 20 minutes after that. That was crazy.
I'm still pondering existence, but at least there's somebody else who goes 17 now, so it's not as otherworldly.
A worthy second was Leon's 200 IM, and specifically the 10 seconds after he turned on back to breast, and it was like 43.6. And I remember trying to think of like, wait a second, what does that mean? What is happening right now? But yeah. In general, Caleb 17, I remember the whole, like, it's so cool to see a race to where there's just like a 3 seconds of silence of everybody processing and then just eruption. That was super cool to see.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Yeah, that we were both at that meet, and yeah, with him turning at the 100 and then just finishing, and then it's like, oh, Destin got the American record too. He was like, so far, that was just blew my mind that Destin got the American record still in that 200 IM. But that turn at the 100 was I think a needle dropped when everyone looked at that scoreboard. It was like, whoa.
That was crazy.
Those are the coolest moments on a pool deck. Like my moment was when Fred Biscay went 18 for the first time, and the NCAA record had stood at 19.0 for like 20 years. And he went 18.7. It was a big drop. And that was that pin drop moment where there's like a matter of disbelief. And then that happened with Caleb 17, of course. And then I remember asking Leon about that after his swim last year, because the moment came in the middle of the race. And that was so strange. Because normally it's after the end result, but he just went out so fast. That everybody gasped halfway through the race. It's like, oh man, what a cool moment to be that swimmer who's the one who's causing everyone to go, whoa, this is possible.
So
crazy to be able to see that on a regular basis. All right, if you could change one rule or like event order or something that's like typical in swimming, what would you change?
I would completely change the way we do dual meets. I would make the format totally different. And I wouldn't have it just like the exact same format every time to where it's like kind of different. I'd like it to be up to maybe like a general order, but up to the home team to pick maybe two or three different events. We could even have like a bucket to pick from, but rather like, I think it just kills the energy of the meet when it's like the two medley relays, and no disrespect to the distance guys, but then when it's two heats of thousands, like it's a long time to keep that energy going. So I think just because we do that, and then it's like, hey, we have a 53 and then a 15 minute break. Like, why don't we just put one of the thousands there, one of the thousands in the other one, and just like try and actually make it to where it's engaging the whole time. And I don't think it has to be the exact same order each time. Like it literally doesn't have to be in the rules, but we just kind of stick to that. But yeah, I would like to make that a lot different, and maybe have relays like different spots. So I do think it's great to always end with the relay. But it might be kind of cool if the whole meet came down to like our Cal meet that ended in a tie. If it was like, okay, this is down to the 100 back or something, like no matter what it is, everybody would be going nuts. So just changing that. And I don't know the exact formula yet, but I think if we just leave it up to everybody to figure out each time, we'd figure it out pretty quickly.
Yeah, for sure. All right. What's the biggest mistake you've made as a coach, and what do you learn from it?
That's a great question. I think, I feel like the biggest mistake comes from the way I viewed coaching. I guess here it is I used to think coaching was about myself giving the answers to the athletes, when success comes when you create good questions and force the athletes to solve them themselves. Anytime, even like technical things, when you spend too much time talking about it and telling them like, okay, here's what you're going to do, watching all these videos, that's not nearly as effective as just sometimes just letting them do it, or trying to add ways for them to learn it. And you're kind of like guiding them without words is the best way of doing it. But that's certainly, like, looking back on my career, I think that limited a lot of people. And I think I made a big, like, specifically, remember my first year and a half really at Utah was way too much in the, that's back to kind of the Brent Russell model of like, okay, repeating this same movement over and over again. And like, I mean, I can literally remember a couple of kids who were good swimmers that I don't remember them ever swimming a stroke other than freestyle. Like, they never had very little variety in what they did. And I thought it was that of like, okay, they're going to be so good because every time we come in here, we're just trying to work on this technique. And I'm telling them each time what it's supposed to look like. And we're doing that over and over again. And they didn't really make that much progress because there was, after doing that for 3 days, there nothing changed. So they weren't getting any new information. So I think that was a just time period where I probably limited a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what it's all about, is learning and development, not only as an athlete, but as a coach too. So,
yeah.
All right. What's the most annoying thing that Bob does?
Trying to think of a,
that's all right. We won't tell him, except we will.
I don't like his music choice in the bands. Going to the meet, I know he does. It's like classical music. He's big into that. And I know he is much more cultured in the type of music, but I don't know. I just don't really feel like listening to that, especially not driving to prelims of a meet. It's like, oh my God. It's just like literally piano is being played. So yeah, I'd say the music choice.
All right. If you're the DJ, what's on your Spotify Wrapped?
On like myself,
what do you play?
Like the music I listen to. I like, I'm actually big into Midwest emo. If you know specifically that genre of music, that's the majority of what I listen to. I like that. I like rap. I even like I like metal too. Some stuff that I think a lot of people don't like, but some intense stuff sometimes.
Hell yeah, the anti-Bob. All right, so final question, and this one's near and dear to us, especially because we don't think Bob is that into it, because he's explicitly said he isn't. But do any of your swimmers do it? How often are you doing social kick in the sprint group?
Unfortunately, we don't. We like pretty much don't ever do that. Something ever assigned. I mean, it's in warm down. They'll sometimes, when there's nothing. Like sometimes I'll just give them like, okay, everybody just has to stay moving until the 20-minute mark or something. But yeah, we don't have much social kick actually programmed in.
you're breaking our heart. One of these days we're going to break in, because every swimmer of yours and Bob's that we talk to wants some of it. So one of these days they're going to get their.
We're starting to taper now. We'll add some in to keep the crowd happy.
I need it. We need to see it. Well, yeah. Herbie, thanks so much for hanging out with us. It's awesome to talk to you. I'm really excited about all the success that you guys have had, and to learn about the wisdom that, you know, you're developing and putting into this next generation of swimmers. It's pretty awesome. I know that you would have loved to swim for yourself. I would have liked to have swum for you with all the stuff that you've shared. So thanks for giving us a little bit of a lens of what it's like to be part of that group. So appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. All right. Well, that's it for this episode of Social Kick. We'll see you next time.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for hanging out with us. If you're enjoying Social Kick, tell your friends about it And be sure to tell us what you liked by leaving a comment and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Instagram. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel, The Social Kick. And you can find all of our content on our website at thesocialkick.com.